Good morning. You are listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey, and you are listening to your KBOO, your very own community connection. We come in strong in the metropolitan area at 90.7. In the Columbia River Gorge, you can hear us at 91.9. In the Willamette Valley, it's 100.7. And on the web, it's KBOO.FM. Good morning.
Good morning, world, and we are so glad that you are here with us. We have an exciting program this morning. You know, this is a time of change. Much has happened in the world in recent months and recent years, and we have an opportunity to speak with a fascinating author and professor this morning who not only writes about what change is, but also is a practitioner. And so we invite you to listen in closely as we have a conversation with our guest this morning. And Celeste?
Yes, he is the author of many books, and the one which we'll be focusing on, but not exclusively, is The Left Alternative. He's been formerly minister to Brazil, a leading social and political thinker in the world today. And as Brazil's Minister of Strategic Affairs, he has undertaken the task of rebuilding and offering new ideas for a better left. The Left Alternative is the name of the book, and we're speaking with Roberto Mangabeira Unga. Good morning, or
good
shall
morning.
I say buenos dias?
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Very good.
Good.
Well, thank you for joining us this morning, and we thank you for the opportunity we had to look at your book, The Left Alternative. And as part of our theme this week here on KBOO, we are looking at opportunities where the left can have a voice and where do we go from here. And so we thought it would be great to begin this morning by speaking with you and for you to share your ideas about the left. And in the beginning of your book, in one of the early pages, you write that I believe that it's time, it is not enough to humanize the social order, but it is necessary to change it. And that reminded me a little bit of Marx's 11th thesis on Feuerbach. You know, philosophers have only thought about the world. The point, however, is to change it. And so we were wondering if we could begin by you sharing a quick reflection about where we are and as a nation and what the left can do to begin to change the way we act and the way we transform our world.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. Ideas all by themselves, of course, can't change the world. But without ideas, for sure, we can't change the world. We now find in the whole world there are two main types of left, or two main types of progressives. There is a recalcitrant left that wants to slow down the march to markets and to globalization, although it has no real alternative to them. It simply wants to make them go more slowly, and it does so in defense of its historical constituency, mainly the organized workforce headquartered in the richer parts of the economy, the capital-intensive parts of the economy. Then there's a second left, the surrendered left, which accepts the market economy and globalization in their present form and simply wants to humanize them. Its motto is humanize the inevitable. Mm. And its program, for the most part, is the program of its conservative adversaries with a humanizing discount. What the world needs is a third left, a reconstructive left, that would seek to reshape the market economy on the basis of a decisive broadening of economic and educational opportunity and redirect the course of globalization so that globalization becomes more hospitable than it is today to strong national experiments in the service of inclusion and broader opportunity. And for all of that, the first order of business is to have ideas, to make proposals. And that's the task of this book of mine, The Left Alternative.
One of the things I think would really be important is to kind of draw out what you meant by the recalcitrant left and how it is not looking to change the access to markets. For some, that might sound more like the right or moderates or conservatives in either party.
Well, another way to say the same thing is this. Traditionally, for much of the last two centuries, the major idea of the left was state control, governmental control of the economy. Either the government would produce directly or it would guide the economy. What's happened in the world as a whole is that people have lost faith in this idea of governmental direction of the economy. And the only thing that seems to remain as an alternative to that idea is a compensatory redistribution through the tax system and through social transfer programs. But that turns out to be very modest. It doesn't redress the major sources of inequality. It becomes a kind of sugarcoating.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
Statism is not feasible and not desirable, the governmental control of the economy. And compensatory redistribution is not enough. So what should the left propose? That's the question before us. And a large part of the answer is that what it should propose is to reorganize our institutions. Now, let me go back a step a little bit into the history of ideas. Nowadays, politicians and thinkers who view themselves as progressives or leftists combine typically a commitment to greater equality, egalitarianism, with skepticism or conservatism about the established institutions. They accept the existing way of organizing the economy and the government as the horizon of their transformative ambition.
And so as the only possible reality is what you're saying.
That's right. And mm-hmm. then the egalitarianism that they profess to be committed to turns into simply this sweetening of the established order. Now, that way of thinking took shape in the middle of the 20th century, in Europe with European social democracy, in the United States with the New Deal.
Yes.
The left or the progressives retreated from the attempt to reorganize politics and to reorganize production. What we discover now is that settlement, that mid-20th century settlement, has to be overturned and redrawn if we are to solve the problems of contemporary societies. But we can't do so by simply returning to the old idea of production by the government or governmental direction of the economy. Instead,
we need to
have a program that proposes to democratize the market and to deepen democracy through institutional innovations.
That's a perfect point for us to take a moment to break and to kind of digest what you said, because I think it's monumental and it's iconoclastic in that we think not redo the current paradigm, but totally reconstruct a new paradigm. You are listening to More Talk Radio. This is Cecil and myself, Celeste. We're speaking with Roberto Unger, and we are talking about the left alternative. And when we left off, we were talking about the need for devising new structures for us to work on, not to sweeten the current structures that we have, the current political arena, but to think in terms of rebuilding them. And Unger, as we've been listening to you, one of the things that's occurred to me is that was the thrust, if you will, the path that the left has taken, at least in the past, well, we'll say maybe 20 years or so. But something seems to have happened. And a lot of that progressiveness and the fresh ideas seem to have gotten lost. And even you yourself say that they're disoriented. Can you kind of clarify what went wrong?
Well, let's take the example of the United States.
Okay.
For half a century, the second half of the 20th century, conservatives have dominated American politics. And that conservative ascendancy was based on two main facts. The first fact is that the Democratic Party, which united most of the progressives in the United States, failed to come up with a sequel to the democratizing program of Franklin Roosevelt. They failed to propose a path for the country that would respond to the needs and aspirations of the working class majority of Americans. And in that vacuum, the Republicans, and more generally the conservatives in the United States, managed to come up with a program that combined material concessions to the moneyed interests with immaterial concessions to the moral and cultural anxieties of the working class. So no sequel to Roosevelt. The last try was under the presidency of Lyndon Johnson. That's a long time ago. And that's been the tragedy of American politics in this historical period. The United States seethes with human energy, by far the most unequal of the rich industrial democracies, but paradoxically a country in which, despite these immense inequalities, ordinary men and women continue to believe that everything is possible.
Yes.
What is therefore necessary is a program that would equip them with instruments and opportunities to make something of all of this creative and constructive energy. It is for that reason that we have to innovate in the way of organizing the economy, organizing education, and organizing democratic politics.
It seems at least that requires many, many approaches, not only in terms of thinking of ideas, but also in terms of organizing energies. It seems that as if part of the problem was one, as you outline, an inability to come up with the next step to FDR and the New Deal, but also I sense an inability to be sensitive to the needs and concerns of in the United States of most workers. Is it possible for those who are on the left to understand the deepest concerns of ordinary citizens?
They need to, but let's focus on three large problems just to give more flesh to this discussion. So first, in the economy, the old form of economic organization, so-called mass production, production of standardized goods and services with rigid machines and production processes, semi-skilled labor, very hierarchical and very specialized work relations, is dying. And it only survives in some parts of the world on the basis of very powerful restraints on wages. There's a new form of production that's being born, a so-called post-Fordist, after Henry Ford's assembly line, a post-Fordist type of production that attenuates the contrast between supervision and execution at the workplace, that mixes cooperation and competition, that transforms work into permanent innovation and collective learning. The problem is that this advanced type of production occurs only in isolated vanguards of the economy, and the vast majority of Americans are excluded from it. So a great task would be to open the gateways of access to these advanced sectors of production and to give people the economic and educational equipment that they need to participate in this new economic world. So, for example, venture capital is investment in emergent business. If private firms don't do enough, then the government has to stimulate this venture capital addressed to the broadening of access to the advanced sectors. Now, let's take a second large problem, education. There are now two different educational systems in the United States. In the elite private schools and in the best public schools in the richest parts of the country, there is a type of education oriented to analysis and problem solving that equips people to participate in this new world of constructive activity. But then there's a second educational system that's still stuck in the old world of information-oriented encyclopedic memorization. And it's useless. It's like a kind of babysitting operation. It doesn't prepare the intellect to create and to build.
It actually prepares a person to be a consumer, and that's
to
about
be a
all.
Consumer or to be a conformist substitute for a machine. And then there's a third large problem, which is the organization of politics. The way democracies are still organized, even in the richest countries in the world, change continues to depend on crisis.
Well, let us hold that thought right there, because your ideas on high energy politics, I think, are fascinating and just what we want to hear on the program today. But I need to take a moment out here to try to capture the idea of high energy in terms of us meeting our goal here for KBOO and our support.
We're speaking this morning with Roberto Unger, who is the author of The Left Alternative. He's a professor at Harvard and formerly served as a government minister, a minister in the government of Brazil. We're speaking this morning on the left, alternatives, and how we can transform the way we approach the world and transform the world. As we left, Mr. Unger was speaking of three specific areas in which we can look at ways of forming and reforming the way we approach the world and the challenges we face. I wanted to continue our conversation with Mr. Unger this morning by asking you not only to continue in terms of talking about these examples, but perhaps you can show us examples, ways, either in the United States or elsewhere, of how the left has transformed itself to revitalize its vital center.
Well, especially, you know, I know that in some of your work, you've mentioned a lot of the restructuring that's been done in Brazil, for example, the emergence of a new middle class. So given the fact that that's the same thing that I think we need to look at here in the States, some examples of like your post-Fordian production systems, for example.
What you see in Brazil and in much of Latin America and in much of the world is the emergence of a new middle class, a second middle class, alongside the traditional middle class. This is a middle class that comes from below, mixed race, dark skin, of people who are struggling to open up small businesses, who study at night, who join new churches and new clubs, and who are inaugurating in the country a culture of self-help and initiative. They are already in command of the popular imagination. They're the example that the majority of working people want to follow. So the big revolution today in a country like Brazil would be for government to use its powers and resources to enable the majority to follow this example. But it can do that, Oni, by reshaping the institutions of the market economy and of democratic politics. That's the key point. The left in European politics for the last 150 years traditionally chose the small business class as its enemy. And that group then became one of the mainstays of the right-wing movements that were so powerful and calamitous in the course of the 20th century. I don't want the contemporary left to repeat that tragic historical mistake.
So in the U.S. today, we see so much in the news today about the emerging anger of people who feel that they're losing their jobs, losing their ability to maintain what they thought was a middle-class lifestyle, and their sense of being left outside, and also a resistance, so-called, to any sort of government action. How is it possible for those on the left to recapture that base, or is it something we should abandon, that base, or what is the core constituency of the left in the U.S. today?
The constituency of the left can't be a narrow group of organized workers in the capital-intensive sectors of industry. For the first time in American history, the majority of unionized workers work for the government. It's a small minority of the labor force that is increasingly perceived and even comes to perceive itself as just one more interest group alongside all the others.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The constituency of the left is the majority of ordinary working class men and women, the people who in the United States are often called middle class, but who in any other country would be called working class. And what is needed is an economic and educational program accompanied by political reforms, reforms in the political institutions, that gives a chance to the little guy, to the ordinary person.
So how do we capture this? Because we say, okay, we need to rebuild, we need to move forward, but one of the failures has been to come up with some kind of compelling draw, some kind of compelling vision that brings people across these party lines. It brings people in, and I don't want to even say bipartisan, because to just describe in terms of two parties is not even sufficient.
Yeah.
There's people all over, and we're not drawing them in.
Well,
we're not
take the example
them.
Of the crisis, the mm-hmm. present economic and financial crisis. The United States is and remains the global epicenter of this crisis. But the debate about the crisis in the United States, and even in the present Democratic administration, remains entirely dominated by superficial themes. The need to rescue the big financial institutions, to regulate the financial markets, and to adopt expansionary fiscal and monetary policies. Meanwhile, deeper and more important themes remain entirely suppressed in the debate. And I'll give you an example of two of them that should be brought to the center of the national agenda. And the task of the progressives would be to bring them to the center of the agenda. The first theme is the relation between finance and the real economy, finance and productive investment. Under the way things are now organized, much of the productive potential of saving is squandered in a financial casino rather than being mobilized for long-term productive investment that would create jobs and opportunities for the majority. The second theme is the relation between redistribution and recovery. The United States built in the second half of the 20th century a market in mass consumption goods. When they asked Franklin Roosevelt what book he would most like to see in the hands of every Soviet child. They expected him to say the Holy Bible, but what he said was the Sears Roebuck catalog. Now, a market in mass consumption goods, in principle, requires a popularization of purchasing power, broad distribution or redistribution of wealth and income. There was a burst of progressive redistribution in the United States in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, but it was followed by decades of regressive redistribution, a violent concentration of wealth and income. So how did Americans manage to establish a market in mass consumption goods at the same time that this regressive redistribution, this increasing inequality, was taking place? Part of the answer is that the redistribution was replaced by an expansion of credit, which was in turn made possible by overvaluation of the housing stock as collateral. So the country established a credit democracy, so to speak, a fake credit democracy, in place of a property-owning democracy, based on real expansion of economic and educational opportunity. That is and should increasingly become a central theme of progressive American politics.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. More talk radio here. We're speaking with Roberto Unger, and we're talking about the left alternative, how we can both envision a new path for the left and to make it real. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the phone number is 503-231-8187. But more importantly, we want you to be supportive of this effort by becoming a member and by joining your family, your friends, in supporting your community connection, KBOO.
We're speaking this morning with Roberto Unger, who is the author of The Left Alternative. We're speaking about what we can do to transform the left and make it an opportunity for transformation for the United States and for its citizen. In a few days, Mr. Unger, the President of the United States, will speak to the Congress and to the American people in his State of Union. If you had the president's ear, and you may do, and you would ask, if he asked you for your opinion, what theme should he touch upon to transform his presidency?
I would argue for a persistent practical utopianism. I wouldn't allow my administration to be obsessed with bickering with the financial interest. I would turn to the main problem, the real economy, and the organization of the system of production, of education, and of politics. And I would be determined to begin a series of experiments that would give wings and eyes to the main attribute of the United States, which is its vitality. The crisis is a tremendous opportunity, and the opportunity provided by the crisis for transformation has already been largely wasted. To change the world, you need a practice of programmatic thinking and transformative politics with two main elements. The first element is a direction. Programmatic thinking is not about blueprints. It's about sequences. It's not architecture. It's music. And the second thing you need is a very concrete definition of the first steps to put you on the path toward the direction you propose.
We do have one caller who's been patient here. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Celeste.
How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. And good morning, Cecil. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Unger. This is a very interesting and important topic. The diagnosis, the prescription, which you proffer, almost sounds FD Rooseveltian. And I like that in the sense that it prepares the whole of the society for taking this musical, like a music chart, for taking and singing and performing this symphony. Unfortunately, if you'll allow me to point out, and I wanted to know how you felt about during the FDR period, during what was the Great Depression and on into the war even, there was a spirit amongst all people, pretty much everyone of all races, with the grand exception, the horrible exception of the Japanese that were interned, of conservation within our home economics. In other words, household conservatism. And I'm wondering if that can, beyond mere education in schools, beyond mere education in books and so forth, if that spirit of household conservatism can't be harnessed in some way and made to play a part of this great symphony. Thank you. I'll take your answer off the air. Thanks, friends.
Thank you. It's a good question, and it kind of buys into some of what you've been saying about education and high-energy politics. But your answer?
My answer is that the United States remains a country of practical inventors, of tinkerers, of people who are out to remake the world.
Build a better mousetrap.
Little piece by little piece. And we now have a structure in place in the country that is a straitjacket that suppresses the most important quality of the nation. So Americans have to begin to take the straitjacket off. And the only way to do that is to insist on a program that isn't satisfied with just regulating the market economy or compensating for its inequalities by retrospective social transfers.
Or retrospective retrofitting.
But
yes.
gives people the instruments to invent, to produce, to reshape, that gives them access to these advanced sectors of production. To do that, we have to cast away all ideological prejudices. Mm. We have to build a form of strategic coordination between government and private firms, especially small and medium-sized firms, that is decentralized, participatory, and experimental. We have to give the whole of the population, and not just an elite, access to analytical problem-solving education, and we have to reshape the political institutions to raise the temperature of politics, that is, to promote popular participation in politics, and to quicken the pace of politics.
Let me jump in right there because we're running out of time, and there's something I really want to pull out when you talk about changing the face of politics and high-energy politics that you describe in your book. And one of the things that I've heard you mention before is one practical way to do this is to push for a change in the election schedule, for example. Can you expand on that a little bit? And then we'd like to get a summation for you.
First thing that's important is increase the level of civic engagement in public life. Public financing of campaigns that in and of itself diminishes the influence of private money on politics, and extended access of the political parties and the organized social movements to the means of mass communication. Quicken the tempo, the pace of politics when there is an impasse between the political branches of government. It should be possible to have a broad programmatic referendum in the country.
Or a special election.
Or to call early elections.
Yes.
Tap the experimentalist potential of federalism by allowing different states or towns in the country to create countermodels of the future, to deviate from the main line. Create in the government a special entity designed to rescue groups from situations of entrenched disadvantage and exclusion from which they cannot escape by their own devices, and enrich representative democracy with some aspects of direct democracy, direct participation of people at the local level in the decisions that influence their ordinary lives.
We have enjoyed speaking with you. We have to have you come back because this was just not enough time. But thank you so much for coming in and exciting people's imagination with the thought of a reconstructed way of doing business, engaging people, and not just engaging them, but educating them so that they can see further.
Thank you so much. And remember that hope is much more the consequence of action than its cause.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Thank
hope
you.
Is the consequence of action. If anything, in the past few days, in the past few weeks, has shown us, is the necessity to find good information and also the necessity to build community to transform our society. And one way you can do that is by becoming a member of KBOO. Thank you for being a part of this, for supporting community radio station. Support community-empowered radio.
Be a force for change.